Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
So let's see. The fiscal cliff, check. The Chinese economy, check. And did I mention we might have more oil in this country than we know what to do with? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Make it a working lunch. Listen to the Marketplace Midday Update podcast for the day's top business headlines. Subscribe on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace podcast for Monday, the 12th of November. Glad you could be with us. We have been exploring on this broadcast of late the idea that the United States might well be on the verge of becoming a petrostate, a really big petrostate, a producer on the order of, say, Saudi Arabia. Turns out, we should have been thinking bigger. There is a new projection out today saying the U.S. will outproduce the Saudis within 5 years. And the projection comes not from an oil company or a bank, but from the Blue Ribbon International Energy Agency in Vienna. By all accounts, this would mean fuel for the U.S. economy as well as actual fuel. The question, of course, is how much and for how long? From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, here's Scott Tong.
The report suggests U.S. oil production will leapfrog the Saudis because of hydraulic fracturing, or fracking, the same thing driving our natural gas boom. Add it up, and the optimists think it equals 3 to 4 million new jobs and ultra-low energy bills for the country. Independent energy economist Philip Verlinger.
Order of the magnitude is the same as the technology boom in the 90s. We are going to see an economic surge very similar to that.
New jobs have already come in drilling and supplying the drillers with pipes and trucks and hotel rooms. Also, petrochemical plants. They use a natural gas product as a cheap raw material. Analyst Ed Morse is with Citigroup.
The U.S. is the cheapest large-scale petrochemical producing country in the world. Massive new petrochemical facilities are being built, not only in Louisiana and Texas, but in places like Pennsylvania and Ohio and West Virginia.
But this being economics, there are competing assumptions and prophecies. Some think the U.S. oil and gas boom is just a one-decade, one-off bonanza. Trevor Hauser is with the Rhodium Group Consultancy.
In the IEA's estimation, the most commercially attractive fields are the ones that are getting developed right now. And tight oil or shale gas fields produce pretty rapidly early on, but then decline fairly sharply.
This decline rate is a big debate, as is whether fracking is an energy game changer equivalent to the internet. At the very least, the energy pros see a solid 10 to 15 year economic boost. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
I can't even imagine what the Europeans would give for an economic boost right now, let alone one that lasts 10 or 15 years. In Greece this weekend, the parliament adopted yet another austerity budget, which will, if things go as planned, free up the latest slice of European Union bailout money. That news reminded us it's been a while since we asked this.
What's up?
What's up?
What's up, Europe?
What's up, Europe? To Athens we go. Thrasy Petropoulos is the managing editor of the Athens News there. Thrasy, good to talk to you.
Very good to be with you.
First questions first, I guess. How's the mood over there now that this austerity budget has passed and, in theory, help is on the way again?
The help is on the way is relative, because I can tell you the mood is not good. It hasn't been good for such a long time. And a third round of austerity in pretty much, as many years. And this is perhaps the harshest of the lot, mostly because it's on the back of the other two.
Do you think people have any hope that there actually is a solution to this thing? Because, as you said, it's been going on for so long now.
Hope has long ago, fallen away as a victim of what's the expectation, really. The average person is concerned. It's not really a matter of whether they're hoping it's going to work. We're told, do it or else, there's no alternative. The problem is, how far do you take it? We've got unemployment rate of 25% in Greece, but one of the key figures is a youth unemployment rate of around 55% now. You're talking about an awful lot of people who simply are saying that they don't have the money, and therefore what's the point of actually being in this currency that we're told that, we have to sacrifice so much to be a part of?
Well, now, do you think there's actually going to be a movement to get Greece out of the euro? I mean, I thought that conversation was had a while ago, or no?
Yeah, it's amazing how quickly it comes around again.
What else are people talking about over there? Is there anything else to talk about?
Precious little. It's so that this whole debt crisis is so complicated that it affects everything in so many different ways. You know, it's interesting being a journalist here because there was once a time when so many other stories, environment would be a big story, education would be a big story, and you could just go on and on and on. Well, we do so little reporting on all of that, and it just shows you that it's come down to money, and that's what it always seems to come down to. So I'm afraid it's all about the debt crisis.
The big thing over here, obviously, is the fiscal cliff. We're having these budget cuts and all kinds of spending problems and all this stuff. Are you guys talking about that at all?
Yeah, of course it's relevant to what's happening here, but you know, I have to be honest and say to you that the more this goes on, that the less people have, the less relevant it becomes as to what else is going on beyond our borders.
Not to make light of any of this, but are there any distractions? Is there any opportunity for fun in Athens today?
So, yeah, you know, the sun still shines here. You know, we've got fantastic weather, and I don't mean that lightly. It's a great country where people can still have a fantastic time as long as you've got money, obviously.
Thrasy Petropoulos, he's the managing editor, the news editor at the Athens News, an English language paper. We got him in Athens, obviously. Thrasy, thank you so much.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Wall Street was up, down, and all the way around today, finished exactly where it started, down to the hundredths of a percent. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The Department of Veterans Affairs says it wants to end veteran homelessness by 2015, just a couple of years from now. A big part of getting that done is going to be helping homeless vets get their disability payments on time, because those checks can make the difference between sleeping under a roof or sleeping out on the streets. Problem is, the VA's benefits system is overwhelmed. The average wait time is more than 8 months. In some places, Phoenix, Arizona among them, that wait can stretch to a year, as Samara Freemark reports.
If you're not a veteran, you probably have no idea how to file a VA disability benefits claim. So I'm going to break it down for you. Step one, call around to maybe a dozen offices to round up a stack of paperwork that proves you were in the service and that you've got a disability. Step two, make a bunch of appointments with doctors. Step three, submit all your forms and paperwork to the VA. And finally, step four, and this one, I have to warn you, is a bit of a doozy. You wait. Usually for a very long time. Now, imagine doing all those steps when you don't have a place to live.
When you live in a van, it's very hard.
That's Hubert Moore. He's a homeless Vietnam veteran in Phoenix. And for years, Moore didn't even know that he was eligible for disability payments. When he finally learned about them 2 years ago, he was living in his car. No safe place to keep documents, no computer to look up information, no phone to make calls. Often not even a good way to get where he needed to go to make a claim.
If you don't have the gas to go down to the main office, then that means you have to catch a bus. If you don't have money to catch a bus, then of course you have to walk. I had to come from way across town, 15 miles from where I was, to go to the office just to make this claim. It took me about 6 or 7 hours just to get there.
2 years later, Moore is still waiting for his benefits. The last he heard from the VA was an email. They said he'd be getting a ruling soon.
I've been trying to figure out putting soon together. Is it soon as a month from now? Or is it 10 months from now? Another year from now? How soon is soon? I still haven't figured it out yet, so I don't know.
The Department of Veterans Affairs says disability benefits payments can help lift veterans out of homelessness or stop them from becoming homeless in the first place. And so the VA gives priority to claims made by homeless veterans. And each of the 57 regional VA offices across the country has a homeless outreach coordinator. Their job is to get the word out, help veterans through the process. But in cities like Phoenix, which has both a large homeless population and a big backlog of claims, there's only one coordinator for more than 1,500 homeless veterans. And so while the VA is doing its best to reach out, it may not be enough.
I used to jump over the fence when I was a kid.
On a recent Tuesday morning, three men sat in the waiting room of the Madison Street Veterans Association, which is a homeless shelter in downtown Phoenix. Bill Gallo was one of them. Last month, Gallo filed a benefits claim for Agent Orange-related diabetes, but he had found the process confusing, and so he'd been waiting here since 6 a.m. to meet with Phoenix's outreach coordinator.
I hear he's real good at getting the guys with disabilities. I need some help because, you know, going in there by myself just doesn't work. And I need somebody on my side to push it forward or get it done right so I can at least get something.
5 hours later, the coordinator still hadn't showed. There had been some mix-up with his schedule. He was actually at a different site that morning. And so Gallo gave up for the day. He'd have to wait a little bit longer to get help. Terry Araman is the program director at Madison Street.
If we continue along the path that we're on right now, we're going to get even more bogged down.
For now, Araman's shelter serves mostly Vietnam veterans. But he's looking ahead to a new generation, returning veterans of Iraq and Afghanistan. A group, he says, that will be at risk for falling into homelessness and who will need their disability benefits.
The country is going to be flooded with veterans coming back from these two wars. You know, and here we are already bogged down. We're already way behind. So if we don't start gearing up now, we're going to miss the boat again, and it's just going to get worse.
How much worse? We'll know soon. In Phoenix, I'm Samara Freemark for Marketplace.
Samara reported that story for the Public Insight Network, which relies on everyday people to help inform stories. You can sign up at marketplace.org. Coming up, thinking about the fiscal cliff in a whole new way.
I made a slight error on the angle of entry and it broke my tailbone.
But first, let's do the numbers. A whole day of trading and shares hardly budged. In fact, it does not get any flatter than this. All three of Wall Street's major indices finished the day less than a single point from where they started. Dow Industrials opened and closed at 12,815, shaved off just a sliver. Same for the NASDAQ, opened and closed at 2904. The S&P 500 nudged a hair's breadth higher, less than a point, closed at 1380. Some lessons today in the alternate realities of the stock market. Let's start with D.R. Horton, which reported sharply higher profits thanks to an improving housing market and then saw its share value fall by nearly 6%. Seems the homebuilder's strong results failed to meet Wall Street's expectations. And then there's Apple. Never mind strong demand for the latest iPhone. Apple kept falling even farther from its very tall tree today, lost another 0.75%. Investors seem to be worried that Apple is having trouble meeting the high demand for that iPhone 5. Shares have now peeled off nearly 25% of their value from their peak in September. The bond market was closed today in observance of Veterans Day. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. We'll see which retail sector did better this past quarter, DIY or outdoor recreation, because Home Depot and Dick's Sporting Goods both report earnings. President Obama will meet with CEOs and union leaders to talk about, what else, the fiscal cliff? Let's hope they keep it civil. Tomorrow is World Kindness Day, after all. I'm Bridget Bodner.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. I don't know if you caught the Sunday morning talk shows this weekend, but there was a pretty good amount of talking about the fiscal cliff and how to fix it, including some reasonably high-profile Republicans talking about tax increases. President Obama has insisted that any deal to get us back off the edge of the cliff has to include higher taxes for the wealthy. $250,000 a year is where he's drawn that line. There is some buzz now about a deal between Democrats and the GOP at $1 million a year. Marketplace's Mark Garrison reports on the financial calculus of all that and whether a million can make a difference.
The income levels we're talking about represent a rather small group of Americans. Just 2% make more than $250,000 a year. Howard Gleckman at the Tax Policy Center says raising the income bar to $1 million would have small impact overall.
You are capturing fewer people, and therefore you will generate less revenue. It's not huge amounts of less revenue, but you are going to capture less revenue.
He also points out that any large-scale budget deal will require much more than higher taxes on the super wealthy.
There just are not enough rich people to pay for the government that we say we want.
But in the discussion of how to define wealthy, the numbers are only part of the story. Tax consultant Clint Stretch says there's a factor that may offset the problem of lost money from lower taxes.
You end up with not raising the kind of revenue that the president might want for deficit reduction purposes, but the politics are much better.
And the politics are key, since Washington is charged with inventing a solution. Moving up the income threshold might be the move that averts the fiscal cliff and buys time for a larger and longer-term budget deal. Thomas Cook is a professor at Georgetown's Business School.
There does appear to be some bipartisan support for the concept that taxes will have to rise for some taxpayers.
But taxing the rich is only a small part of a budget solution. There will be other tough choices, including serious spending cuts to programs both parties love. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
2 weeks after Hurricane Sandy hit the Northeast, New York Governor Andrew Cuomo says he is going to ask the federal government for $30 billion in disaster relief. Part of that might wind up going to the thousands of people in the region who still need a place to live. Marketplace's Dan Bobkoff has more now on plans for the displaced.
Even before Sandy hit, it was hard to find an apartment in New York. Now thousands more need a place to live, and landlords like Ron Molis want to help.
Can we provide these apartments in some expedited way for people who are put out of their homes, you know, not just for a week or two, but really for the months?
Out of his company's more than 8,000 apartments, about 150 are vacant. Molis is among New York's big landlords who've been meeting with government officials since the storm to figure out a way to house the displaced. One idea is to create a directory of what's available for rent, but there are issues to work out. For instance, he says many rentals have income requirements.
Even if they do qualify for the income, they might not have the paperwork because a lot of their paperwork might have been destroyed or might still be in the homes they were flooded out of.
A number of rules will have to be relaxed under the circumstances, like allowing tenants to stay less than a year. Allison Badgett heads the New York State Association for Affordable Housing.
So we have to make sure that all the waivers are in place to allow us to use this housing for temporary housing.
A plan is expected by the time President Obama tours storm damage in the area Thursday. Molis has been here before. He's been developing affordable housing in New Orleans post-Katrina. He says these efforts will help, but...
Well, I don't think you're going to solve the problem this way, but you may be able to make a dent.
And getting at least some of the Sandy victims in vacant apartments can be a win-win for landlords and the displaced. In New York, I'm Dan Bobkoff for Marketplace.
The most closed of closed-door meetings is going on in Beijing this week, the Chinese Communist Party Congress. Delegates will ratify the secret selection of the men who are going to run the world's second biggest economy for the next 10 years. Those men will face some challenges along the way. China's economy could be in for a harder landing than anybody thought. And those challenges become clear once you look outside the halls of power. Our China correspondent Rob Schmitz is in Beijing.
Inside Beijing's Great Hall of the People this week, the pomp and ceremony of an historic leadership transition, long-winded, ambiguous speeches from officials about China's future path. But what about the people who, this week, aren't allowed inside the Great Hall of the People? A stone's throw away in a quiet neighborhood of twisted alleys known as a hutong, shopkeepers Sun Zongyi and his wife Song Qingping were content to watch the opening ceremony on TV.
I was deeply moved by President Hu's speech when he said, no matter how high your position or who you are, if you are corrupt, you will be punished. I applauded.
The 75-year-old couple share their one-room home with four dogs. One half of the room is their tiny shop. The other half is taken up by their bed. The canines scurry underneath it, barking at each other. Their washroom is a public restroom across the alley. It's a modest lifestyle, but they don't have any complaints about money. Song says her pension of $30 a month is sufficient. Her daughters and grandchildren help them out, too. Their salaries have been going up for years, she says. Slower GDP growth in China may worry economists and the markets, but a closer look at China's economy shows there's something else going on. Household income in China is steadily rising, and that's boosting consumption. While this means better salaries for Song's kids and grandkids in the workplace, it also means more outsiders moving into Beijing to get in on all the new consumer activity, setting up shops next door.
Business used to be good, but lately more shops have been popping up all over the place, and I can't keep up.
She says she's lucky now if she gets more than one customer a day. And while China's leaders in the Great Hall of the People talk about corruption among government officials, here in the Hutong, they're dealing with the same issue.
There's an old saying, as the forest grows, you get new kinds of birds. When Mao ruled China, you could leave your doors open. Now thieves are everywhere, stealing everything. They're all migrants from poor parts of China.
Old Swin interrupts his wife, saying everyone who's corrupt, officials or migrant thieves, deserve to be shot. Further down the Hutong, migrant Guangguo Xia is staying out of trouble, selling vegetables from her corner store. She came here more than a decade ago from Shandong province along with her newborn son. He's grown up here and he's ready to attend high school, but he'll have to return home. He's not a legal resident of Beijing. It's like this throughout much of China. Migrants are typically treated like illegal immigrants inside their own country. Many of them aren't eligible for social benefits like health care and schooling in the cities they move to. Guan says she hopes China's leaders will change the system. Otherwise, she fears her son will be forced to attend a poor quality school and won't be able to compete for a good job after he graduates. Competition, she says, is impacting her on all sides. She's lost business this year to new grocery store chains popping up outside her neighborhood. And as Guan, Song, and other small business owners struggle with the realities of market-based capitalism on the street, China's leaders gather behind closed doors to discuss giving more access to private companies and economic sectors dominated by the state, the aviation industry, telecom, you name it. Economists agree if these changes aren't made, China's economy will falter. But more competition can be scary, even for those inside the Great Hall of the People. In Beijing, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
We went over rebranding strategies for the fiscal cliff on Friday and why that may or may not work. Now some business and interest groups think it might be worth giving pure marketing a go. They want to get Congress to just fix it. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer reports from Washington.
The fiscal cliff ads are dramatic and to the point.
America's CEOs have a message for Washington. Don't take our country over the fiscal cliff.
That ad is from the Business Roundtable, which represents many of the nation's biggest corporations. It starts airing on Washington radio stations this week. Another group began its ads the day after the election. It's called the Campaign to Fix the Debt. It has big business backing, and it's headed by Maya McGinnis. She says the ads are aimed at members of Congress.
So we know that there are going to be hard choices involved, and we want to let them know we have your back.
McGinnis is hoping lawmakers will be more willing to buck their parties if they know they have business support. Stephen Hess is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. He says it was smart to have the fiscal cliff warning delivered by CEOs.
Every member of the House knows the business groups in his neighborhood and will be more apt to listen to them than others.
Initially, at least, the ads will only appear in Washington. I know how disappointed the rest of you are, but more ads are planned for later, targeting the districts of wavering representatives. Elizabeth Wilner is vice president of Kantar Media CMAG. She says outside the Beltway ads might not be welcome.
There are many people sitting at home who probably hit their limit on political ads and are happily watching car ads and other sorts of ads, not expecting to see anything political.
But Wilner says at least they won't be attack ads. The only character being smeared here is the fiscal cliff. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, picking up where Nancy left off with the fiscal cliff thing. You know, sometimes to really understand a vexing problem, you just need to think about it differently. So we got Stephen LeBoux on the phone. He's an assistant diving coach at Pinecrest School in Boca Raton, Florida. More to the point, though, he's also the number one ranked American cliff diver. Steve, welcome to the program.
Hey, great to be here.
So listen, man, as you stand there on the edge of a cliff looking into the maw of certain death, what goes through your mind?
You know, it's interesting. When you're up there, there's such a huge range of emotions. And, I mean, fear is obviously the number one thing. You're looking over the edge. And so, I mean, what I try to do is just stay calm up there and try and mentally rehearse as best I can.
Do you ever think to yourself, I could just turn around and walk away and everything would be fine?
A couple times. Actually, when I was first learning, I took a bad wipeout one of the first tries, and I remember standing up there just thinking, why am I doing this? I could absolutely turn around, and no one would, you know, get down on me for it. So, you know, it takes a certain level of perseverance.
I bet. What's a wipeout in cliff diving like, anyway? Because that's where we seem to be going with this whole physical cliff thing.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, the slightest miscalculation could be pretty dramatic. So, I mean, I made a slight error on the angle of entry and then broke my tailbone.
It's almost poetic how much this applies to the fiscal situation in this country right now. All the way from slight miscalculation to broken tailbones.
Broken wallets, maybe.
That's right. Now how high are the cliffs you guys usually jump off of?
We consistently compete from about 27 meters.
So that's like 85, 90-something feet?
It's right up there between 85 and 90, I believe.
All right. So we just for the heck of it did a little math game, and we took the physical cliff and we said, well, how high would it be if you stacked it in bundles of $100 bills? And if you do the math, it's $560 billion in $100 bills. Works out to 380 miles high.
Wow.
So we figured that was too high. So we said, well, what if you do it in bundles of $100,000 bills? Because they're actually out there. And that's 2,006 feet high.
Wow.
Now, what do you suppose it's like to dive off a cliff that's 2,006 feet high?
I mean, at that point, you're talking about skydiving, not so much cliff diving. So, I mean, the world record right now is about 175 feet. And I mean, the requirement for that to be a world record was that you had to leave the water under your own power without assistance. And only one guy did it.
Did he walk away?
He certainly did.
All right. Stephen LeBoux, he's the number one ranked professional cliff diver in this country. Steve, thanks a lot.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So there you go. That's Marketplace from APM, American Public Media. Today, the Dow, the NASDAQ, and the S&P 500 all closed basically flat. Our producers include Bridget Bodner, Millie Jefferson, John Ketchum, Megan Larson, Joel Patterson, and Jolie Podokas. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you back here tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.